please all sit down, please? Good evening, and welcome to the 7th ordinary meeting of the 175th session of Literary and Scientific Society. Tonight's debate is This House Regrets the Fall of the USSR. Before we get into any order of business, do we have any council announcements?
Everybody's left.
They'll be back.
My announcement.
I'll go to Sam first.
What's that? Was my announcement.
Right.
Everybody's left, but you should know.
If you are a new speaker and would like to compete in the Gotham competition, which is our new speaker competition, there is a link in our Instagram bio where you can sign up and give me all your details so I can introduce it.
Brilliant. And now I'd like to move on to the minutes, so I'd like to welcome Acting Secretary Grant Warren up to read the minutes.
On the 26th of October 2023, the Queen's University Belfast Literary and Scientific Society convened for the 6th ordinary meeting of the 175th session for the motion This House Would Live in a Genderless Society. As usual, the meeting began with announcements, of which there was nothing of value. Following a reading of the minutes, for which there were two objections, the meeting moved to private members' business. Sir Keir Starmer, also known as Keir Robertson, raised the idea of an upper age limit for politicians. Responses were heard from the mother of the house, Miss Kira Swaley, HLM, Mr. Jonathan Massey, Mr. Dermot Hamill, HLM, HLM, Mr. Ryan Kilgore, and Mr. Max Kieran. The issue was closed by Mr. Sam Hazlett, defending the rights of old people, as ever. And of course, as become customary for the society, the French were again insulted. I can only endorse that wholeheartedly. President's questions then took place. Madam President McSparren was reprimanded for her apparent lack of goose-related knowledge. Her favourite artist is Bob Dylan. She also appeared to threaten the US envoy, Mr. Joseph Kennedy III. After President's questions, the vote of power opinion was held. There were 11 votes for aye, 3 votes for nay, and 20 abstentions. So, in theory, the Alliance vote took it, but the opposition, in the context of this debate, the opposition had it. It was deemed His Grace the Archbishop of Kildare, Fintan K. Lawler, HLM, did an alright job as secretary. I hope I live up to such lofty praise. First on the proposition was Ken from Barbie, also known as Harry Shaw. He discussed issues of linguistic third genders and differences in cultures, particularly focusing on Samoa. Points were heard regarding cultural notions of gender and changing attitudes and the difference between a rather dull-sounding sexless society and a genderless one. Rugby also played a surprisingly prominent part in the speech. First on the proposition was Patrick Davis. He questioned the nature of humanity and how it relates to how one sees himself in relation to others. He said he was struggling to fathom the idea of a genderless society and proposed that issues may arise amongst existing transitioning and non-binary issues, and a further crisis of identity may strike these people. The speech was over time and it began to sound like something Ronald Reagan would have said. Second on the proposition was Misha Gerrard, who discussed how this motion is about the removal of discrimination rather than gender as a concept. Misha then infantilised the crowd before speaking about Firestone, a noted feminist author, and the multiple quarrels with the world and everything in it. Points were heard regarding the freeing of women from biological reproduction. Star Trek made a surprise appearance. Live long and prosper. I just did a really shitty Vulcan salute there. The second speaker for the opposition was Jonathan Geronimo, aka Jonathan Duranjan. Very nice name. Hereafter known as the Supreme Leader, addressing only the men in the room and bearing pictures of the great Kim Jong-un, he made the whole debate very entertaining. He compared famine in North Korea to intermittent fasting. He argued North and South Korea had inexplicable links to gendered and genderless cultures. Long live the revolution. The final speaker for the proposition was the mother of the house. Kira pointed out the lack of points made by the opposition and surgically pulled apart the opposition on their points like something out of a horror film. She proposed the idea of pre-installed personality traits before speaking about her personal experiences and a farmer wearing a dress. The final speaker for the opposition was Daniel Rankin. He equated colour blindness and genderlessness. He claimed gender isn't arbitrary. The majority of his speech was nullified by a well-placed POI, but he carried on commendably. Questions were heard from Ryan Hoey, HLM, Dermot Hamill, HLM, HLM, Pope Benedict XVI, aka Luke Maguire, who quoted a woman, President Emeritus, just for clarity, it says who quoted a woman, comma, President Emeritus Daniel McCormick, HLM, so forgive me, I did not put these minutes together. And Sir Keir Starmer again. Following the debate and questions from the House, the vote on speaker ability took place. There were 20 votes for the proposition, 5 votes for the op and 8 abstentions. So the proposition had it. May I take the minutes as read?
Aye.
Aye.
And now we move on to private members' business, where you can discuss anything that you've seen in the news or you just want to bring up to the House. Do we have a piece of private members' business? Keir, please.
Right. Okay, so, as we know, people, like, in earlier years, like, humans were generally shorter. And not only that, but nutrition people had in, like, the earlier years, that was also very poor too. So what I think is everybody in this room, in a fist fight, could beat Alexander the Great, given he's probably way shorter than all of us and way more malnourished.
Ryan?
I think that's true since Alexander the Great is dead.
Anyone else on this? James?
Probably a sobering fact that, you know, by our ages, Alexander the Great would be dead for a year or two. So again, you know, I think my lack of muscle in general, could probably beat somebody who's probably getting red and dead.
I'll go to Rory then, Ryan.
I think we have to take into account the muscle mass of Alexander the Great. Now, if you look at Neanderthal, I'm not used to a drunk Neanderthal. They can lift twice the amount of human mass, but they're like 5'3". So, you know.
I don't know, Rory. Okay, Ryan.
His height is estimated at 5'7", so I think you're just thinking about me. You're not sure you're not giving Alexander the Great recognition
he deserves. I'll go to Sam then Eli.
I was just going to ask him what you're talking about.
Alexander the Great. Okay, Sam.
Yes, I would say that we're discussing mutant arthritis, but we should not shy off there in his absolute.
Do we have another piece of private member business?
Really skipping the barrel tonight.
Brian?
The town of Middleton in County Cork has very nearly been wiped off the map by flooding. I was wondering what the House thinks of, given the impending climate disasters of the next couple of decades, whether we should just be going to coastal towns, moving all the people, and then demolishing said towns to make a new beach.
John?
First of all, Middleton isn't a coastal town, fairly far inland. And secondly, the important bits of Middleton stayed dry, so ultimately it was not really a big deal.
I'll go to Ethan, then James, then Ryan.
In my opinion, anything that wipes Cork off the map is positive. Yes.
James?
I just like to note that the individual who told us everyone has suggested a solution to contentious issues was to move everyone out of nuke
said areas, so I think someone has a little worrying interest in blowing up places.
Brian? Anyone else on Middleton flooding? Here?
I think we should probably be more hesitant at taking a bunch of people out of their sort of area and then trying to get them into a new home, like, right away, like, at once. I feel like there'd be a lot of sort of problems with that, like, not only objections from the people living there as is, but also, like, trying to get them housing as well. That's going to cause a lot of stress to, like, the families and the people that live there when a lot is important that, like, with more impending climate disasters, we try to accommodate. We don't want to just do things so rashly and so quickly.
Anyone else on this?
Please. I like how Keir actually analysed that as a serious proposition and thoroughly debunked it as if it wasn't just a joke. That's my only contribution.
Thank you.
Do we have any other pieces of private members' business?
I have no idea if this is the morning, as I literally just arrived, but Taylor Swift is a thing. Those of you who don't know, she recently released her re-recorded album, I believe 1989, correct me if I'm wrong. Yeah, it sold like hell, obviously, because I think she could poop and it would sell well at this point, but essentially, what's more interesting now is the fact that record companies are now trying to like write into contracts and things like that that they essentially can't do what Taylor did, because in re-recording her albums, and because of her fan base being very loyal, it's essentially meant that the assets that they bought have tanked horrifically. So now, something that Taylor originally did, I believe, to like put more power into artist hands, is now trying to be outdone by record companies. So yeah, what do you think about it?
I'll go to Grant.
I just don't see the whole thing about re-releasing music that's already been popular and has already had a shelf life. I think it's a money grab. I don't think Taylor Swift is being particularly innovative in doing this. I get the point of wanting to reclaim the royalties and ownership over her own music, but simply Forbes, in the past weeks, says that she's attained billionaire status. She wasn't someone who needed this money. And I think the idea of relying on album re-releases, no matter what the principle is behind it, because it is a good principle to take ownership over your own music, but trend of re-releasing albums and the kind of bandwagon jumping to Taylor Swift fans is just a bit tiresome, to be honest. And it just shows you just how much of it is a joke.
Like,
these things, this is seen as like a big thing, but it's just a bandwagon joke.
I'll do this based on who I saw first. Kira, then Daniel, then Tiernan, then Jack.
Right, so, 2 points. One, I think that I honestly don't mind. I'm a big fan of artists having control over their work. I think that it's important that they have as much rights over it. And two, Taylor Swift isn't that fast. Like, Usain Bolt. Bolt's in his name. He's fast. He's quick. Taylor Swift, how fast can she run? Not that fast. Anyway, thank you.
Daniel?
I just think we've got an issue with what Lee Grant's point there I think as much as the same as what, anyone who isn't a huge fan of Taylor Swift knows it. It does, which is she's a hateful bastard. it's one hell of a power we can get to do what she's doing. I think it's pretty good. And I just want to mention for James' sake, Daniel at all, and
Well, I stand on reference of Danny McDonald. Andrew Fantano said that the recent Taylor Swift album was underwhelming, and I think the music by the line in here.
Does anyone else want to speak like this? No one else on Taylor Swift? Sad times. Do we have any other piece of private members' business? I'll go to Misha.
Oh, I just wanted to say that I was offered into James Acaster tickets tonight instead of going to this, and I turned them down.
I'm not gonna lie, if I was offered them, I would.
Such a
shitter.
Thank you so much.
I think Ryan had his hand up first. Yeah, Ryan.
James also.
I would like to propose a motion that House folk always have someone stand outside an ordinary meeting with a pumpkin on their head.
Second.
We have to do the votes now?
Yes.
Okay. If you would like, outside of every ordinary meeting, for someone to stand outside with a pumpkin on their head, please raise your hand now.
I'm only voting aye.
Okay. And if you don't want someone to be standing outside the room with a pumpkin on their head, please raise your hand now. Three. And if you'd like to abstain, one. Okay, so that is 22 votes for people having pumpkins on their heads, 3 votes against, and 1 abstention, meaning that, not constitutionally, but kind of constitutionally, there will have to be someone standing with a pumpkin on their head. Okay, I'll go to you.
If we're going to have someone stood outside with a pumpkin on their head, how many people can we get together to take photographs of them? What happens?
This isn't a... Ask the bots. Ask the bots. Anybody on how many people we can get taking photographs of people with pumpkin on their heads? Is there any new, like, normal piece of private member business, or is that it?
Nobody interesting to hear this week.
I'll go to Ronnie.
I
was just wondering what the house's opinion is on the Somerset gimp.
Very definite setup for that. Okay, Misha, please. Okay. Anyone else on the Somerset gimp? Okay, then. Okay. Rory?
What?
Okay, anyone on copycat Somerset gimp? Sam?
Well, I don't know what the Somerset gimp is, but I would like to say. I believe James Acaster to be shit. Put that away. I turned on the television one day and he was talking about cheese, so I turned him off. So I'd like to propose the issue and invite Les Dawson instead.
Don't second him. Wait, I'll go Misha, then Keir, then Ronnie, then Tiernan, and then we'll move on. Okay.
I'm not saying correlation is causation, but George Osborne moved to my village the same year. The same year that I was made of the parents. So do we think that might be related?
Keir?
Right, so if there are copycats at the Somerset game, I think we need to just take no prisoners. We should have that kill on site policy, like the silence.
No. Ronnie?
What? Can I propose that we have a terrific gimp who stands outside the door?
Ronnie, that's here. Someone's on my head.
Tiernan.
Right, first of all, my first point is Sam. You had people at a sale with Sam, James Acaster.
Yes.
Is love for cheese. Do you not like cheese?
I like cheese, but I'm talking about the television.
Why?
Sam doesn't have a television.
I will take one more piece of private members' business, please.
This is on the gimp.
Yes, okay. That's what I wanted to be on.
I'm worried.
I'd just like to read this quote. I am not a gimp. I do not own a gimp suit. I'm not in a gimp suit. That's from the man who was arrested. So, is it really appropriate to call him the Somerset Gimp, given this evidence?
What's he arrested in?
It's basically an American Horror Story.
And I think we'll move on.
Thank you.
To President's questions, where you can ask me anything that you want, as long as it's not political or something like that. I'll go to Ryan.
Madam President, will you lead the House in a rendition of Happy Birthday to wish Panama a successful 120 years since its foundation?
But no, because it's actually been 119 years and 364/3 days, so it's not their birthday yet, so I won't do it.
Shame.
I'll go to Rory.
Do you support the actions of the Somerset Gang?
I actually do. Because he was they really misrepresented him in the news to make it seem like he was like just terrorizing like female drivers, but he was just terrorizing everyone. This was non-judgmental gimp behavior. And it was, I support it. Okay. I'll go to James.
Have you enjoyed having competent secretaries these last 2 weeks? Is it change from usual?
No. I'll go to Sam.
Have you improved your knowledge of peace? And if not, will there be an ETM forthcoming to decide the president who does?
It was like, you told me its name. It was like the brown, sleeked feather goose or something. That's what you said. I don't know. I'll go to Keir.
Madam President, would you like to see a photo of my dog? Does he care?
Yeah.
May I also see the
so ugly. Just kidding.
Oh, fuck you.
It's a cute dog. Tiernan? Oh. I'm gonna do something that Rory's been asking. I had Smarty cereal, which is just Smarties and milk. Siri, I told you no one would find it that funny.
Thompson. We have breakfast tomorrow.
Here. I don't know. Do we have any other questions? With that, I'd like to move on to the vote of prior opinion. So if you side with the proposition this week and you do regret the fall of the USSR, please raise your hand now. 1, 2, 8. And if you side with the opposition, you don't regret the fall of the USSR, please raise your hand now.
French Marxist, 6 bullets in the back of my
head. So 23.
With French
gloss. Yes.
I've got another one.
They are 1, 2, 3.
That's all we just did.
Just give a 17 then. Yeah. And if you'd like to abstain on the motion, please raise your hand. Oh, okay. I got 8. Mr. Secretary, can we please have the vote of prior opinion?
Okay, so for the vote of prior opinion, we have 10 votes for the prop, 17 for the op, and 6 abstentions. So the opposition passes.
Yeah. And before we go into the speeches, I'd like to read out the rules of debate. Each speech is 7 minutes long. First and last minute are protected time, which will be signalled by a bell, meaning that you can only POI people in the middle 5 minutes. To POI, raise your hand and say point of information on that point, or POI, please keep your POIs to 10 seconds and no barricading, meaning wait at least 15 seconds after giving a POI to give another one. Also, very importantly, no back and forth. And lastly, no swearing. And with that, I'd like to welcome Cormac McSparren up to open the proposition.
Good start. So, today I'm here to talk about the end of communism, the fall of the USSR, or really the overthrow of communism. Not that long ago, I studied in great detail how some of the Irish socialists during the 1960s here, during a time of Catholic domination of ideology, critically examined this country and the world. There was one particular line stood out. One stated at a sort of deathbed interview he did, "Our socialism grew from struggle and practice, and the theory came later." Now that was no easy task. In a theocratic Ireland, to go through such an ideological development at a time of great poverty, to realise that there could be a different world, and it was true of Ireland and most of the world, anti-communism was tirelessly propagated more like a religious orthodoxy than a political analysis. This anti-communist ideological framework could transform any data about the USSR or any existing socialist society into some sort of hostile evidence. If the Soviets refused to negotiate a point, they were intransigent and belligerent. If they appeared willing to make concessions, this was but a skillful ploy to put us off our guard. By opposing arms limitations, they would have demonstrated their aggressive intent, but when in fact they supported most armament treaties, it was because they were mendacious and manipulative. If the churches in the USSR were empty, this demonstrated that religion was suppressed. But if the churches were full, which happened on occasion, this meant that the people were rejecting the government's atheistic ideology. If the workers went on strike, as happened on infrequent occasions, this was evidence of their alienation from the collectivist system. And if they didn't go on strike, this was because obviously they were intimidated and lacked freedom. A scarcity of consumer goods demonstrated the failure of the economic system. An improvement in consumer supplies simply meant that the leaders were attempting to placate a rest of population, and so to maintain a firmer hold over them. What we see is a non-falsifiable orthodoxy so well marketed by the ruling interests, it affects people across the entire political spectrum. Even if you didn't like Stalin and his autocratic system of government, if you ever suggest there was anything positive about the Soviet Union, you're essentially confined to being painted as a little Stalinist by those both on the left and the right. Communists, we are told, no thank you, hunger for power. No, you're on my side. What are you on about?
Are you on my side?
Okay. It was autocratic, but it was what was needed, if that's what you're about to ask. Communists, we are told, hunger for power rather than wanting the power to end hunger. My real sin, which I plan to commit tonight, which I've already committed, is that I questioned, rather than uncritically embraced, the media orthodoxy about socialism. My other sin, which I also plan to commit, is that I can see positive things that existed about the USSR. Here was a nation that threw back and destroyed the Nazi beast and sustained 80% of the Allied losses in the war. No, thank you. 22 million dead, and I thought that was a debt that humanity owed the Soviet Union. Here was a nation that in 3 decades made industrial advances equal of what took the capitalists a century whilst feeding and schooling its children. No, thank you. Rather than working them 14 hours a day as the capitalists did during their industrialized revolution and are still doing today. Here was a nation that provided vital assistance, armed medical material, to liberation movements in Vietnam, Cuba, Angola, South Africa. As Nelson Mandela pointed out in an interview in 1990, the interviewer doing some type of balancing act. Well, the US have done this and the Soviets have done that. What do you have to say about this, Mr. Mandela? And Mr. Mandela says, unequivocally, please do not denounce the Soviet Union. They have been our greatest allies in the struggle against apartheid and racism. Only Nelson Mandela could have got away with saying something like that on national television. Sure, go for it.
You're completely ignoring what the debate is. If this fight is a this house regrets debate, you must create an alternative reality where the Soviet Union did not fall and just come. You can't just complain about it. So unless you provide an alternative history, your side fails.
I think go into that in great detail. But what I'll say is that the context is important because it's important to actually understand what happened across those 70 years. You know? Sure, okay. Some of you may be thinking, but apartheid ended after the collapse of the Soviet Union. That is no mystery because, as we all know, and you will all know before the evening's over, right-wing dictatorships were either allowed to exist or were installed across the world by the Americans and their allies to halt the chances of socialist revolutions across the world. So if you wonder why so-called progressive countries were okay with South African apartheid or fascist Spain, that's why. Here was a country that did guarantee its citizens a minimum level of economic security. Here's another thing that's never mentioned. A country which performed the rescue and survival of 3 million Soviet Jews in World War II, which is far more than you can say of any other country. And some say the collapse of the Soviet Union does not represent, no thank you, a defeat for socialism because socialism never existed. What you had was state capitalism. I take a differing view. With the birth of the Soviet Union, it came under attack. Between 1918 and 1920, 14 capitalist countries, including the United States, invaded Soviet Russia in a bloody but unsuccessful attempt to overthrow the Bolshevik government. For the People's Revolution to survive, it had to seize state power and use it to break the stranglehold exercised by the ruling class over the society's institutions and resources, and to withstand the reactionary counterattack that did come, whether it be the invasion of the Soviet Union, the civil war funded by Western powers, economic embargo, the Nazi invasion, the Cold War, the arms race. Perhaps socialism would have looked differently if it were ever been allowed to evolve naturally. No, thank you. The pure socialist view does nothing to answer the question of how will a decentralized society, simply run by the workers, with no state apparatus, respond to the inevitable invasion. That invasion did arrive right at the Soviet doorsteps and has arrived for nearly all socialist societies. Therefore, the pure socialist view is simply ahistorical and has nothing to offer to face the actualities of how socialism comes under siege. And I could bore you all with discussions around the Soviet Union being a counterpart to American hegemony. Instead, I will discuss the influence the Soviet Union had on all of your lives. The overthrow of communism gave the green light to the exploitative nature of Western corporate interests, no longer needing convince workers that they live better than their counterparts in the Soviet Union and no longer restrained by a competing system. Since the collapse, many Western countries have rolled back the many gains that the working people in the West had won over years, and now the free market, in its meanest form, was essentially emerged triumphant and in the East, and so obviously there was a counter in the sort of West as well. Capitalism of a human face, which you've probably heard before, has essentially been replaced by capitalism in your face. With austerity and the destructiveness of the neoliberal world order, we now see that socialists and their allies held at bay, with many never understanding that the existing socialist powers played in tempting the world impulses of Western capitalism and having perceived socialism as nothing but an unmitigated evil. I'm finishing. Many did not anticipate the losses that were to follow. Some of them still don't get it. Thank you.
Thank you, Cormac, and I'd like to welcome Jonathan Massey to open the opposition.
The fall of the USSR. Can I start again?
Yes, sir.
Can we just.
Well,
this happened. Yeah.
Somebody screamed.
Jeremy's
not
on the stairs again, so we don't know where
he's
gone.
There's no stairs. Okay, Evan. Do you want to just start?
Yeah, sure. Right. For the second time. The fall of the USSR was a great geopolitical tragedy, perhaps the greatest of the 20th century. Or at least that's the view that the three speakers on the proposition will try to present to you. It's also the view held by the reasonable, stable, sensible man that is Vladimir Putin. Tonight, do not let the pure propaganda talked about by these people blind you. Do not let them transform the data as they have already accused us of doing. He talks about how we need context, how it's important. I agree, context is important, and that's why I will try and present you some unbiased context to the fall of the USSR. The fall of the USSR was ultimately a good thing. From the early 1980s and the mid-1970s, the Soviet economy had already begun to stagnate, with terrible sort of ramifications on the quality of life. In the 1980s, productivity was growing at a rate below zero. The economy was becoming less productive. They were having to import wheat from the United States to feed their population. Although, did they feed their population? I think we've all heard of bread lines. Gorbachev was forced in the 1980s to limit production at 1980 levels. Obviously a huge limiting factor on the Soviet economy. And so when the proposition talks about the scarcity of goods, you have to know that the scarcity of goods was an active decision made by the Soviet government and not something that the West was just sort of trying to make up to criticize the USSR. The question is, of course, why? Why did the economy of the Soviet Union fail so drastically? And why only in the 1980s? I'm sure if they were to respond to what I've said so far, they'd point out the incredible rate of growth before the 1970s and 80s, but ultimately this growth was a lie. The proposition asks why the Soviet Union could grow faster than capitalist countries in a better way than capitalist countries. It's because the capitalists had already done the growing. Once the Soviet Union got anywhere near to catching up with capitalist growth, they found themselves at a dead end. They could not innovate enough. They could not feed their population. They could not give their population the goods that they needed. This is due to the focus of the Soviet Union on industrialization, on urbanization, and not on the fundamental needs of the consumers.
Point of interest?
On that point?
Yes.
The main reason for the really forced industrialization was that Stalin essentially predicted that the Nazis would invade, because that's where the war was essentially meant to be at the start. Do you not think that they did that because, you know, the SCB will arm themselves and defend themselves? So it's a bit more than just about the economic side of things.
So I appreciate your point, but these economic policies continued well after the Second World War. They were not, of course, you have the initial militarization drive before the Second World War, but ultimately it was an active choice by the Soviet government, by the Politburo, to continue pushing for industrialization, urbanization, weaponization, and fundamentally focus their economy around these sort of flawed ideals instead of actually providing the people what the people want. It's ironic that a country that was supposed to be for the people, by the people, ended up ignoring the very people it was supposed to serve. No, thank you. Ultimately, the Soviet Union also fell victim to dictatorship, autocracy. If you look at Soviet spending, a lot of the spending went to vanity projects, frankly, things that were never going to work, that had no sort of relevance. You have things like the Okhrano plan, which is a sort of weird boat plane hybrid capable of going 300 miles an hour above the surface of the ocean. What was the point of that? Nobody's really sure, because the Soviets terminated the project after sinking significant funds into it. You had other vanity projects. You had the Tu-144. The capitalists in the UK and France built the Concorde, so the Soviets scrambled to respond, and in doing so, built the world's first commercial supersonic airliner. Only no one in the Soviet Union could afford to fly on a supersonic airliner, and it was very poorly designed, which meant it crashed a lot. What was the point of spending all the money on it? Purely to try and save face and present to the West that the Soviet Union wasn't creaking at the seams and about to fall apart, which it was. Sure.
Did the Concorde fail?
No, the Concorde did not fail. The Concorde successfully was in revenue service for several years, I think 30 or 40. And sorry, no back and forth. If you look at the Soviet Union, they were spending four times as much on their military relative to the USA, and this is in an economy that in 1989 was only half the size of the USA's. There is no way that an economy like the Soviet Union's could sustain this spending, and ultimately the fact that it collapsed was not surprising. Now, you may think, all of this is the fall of the USSR, all of this is to be regretted, but no. The decline of the USSR and the fall of the USSR must be very clearly separated. The decline was something that was perhaps bad. It was certainly bad for the average Soviet citizen. The fall was not a direct result of the decline, but it was the most natural end point. After the decline, the most humane thing to do was to sort of take the Soviet Union out back and shoot it. Ultimately, after the fall of the USSR, Eastern Bloc countries became the second largest foreign aid recipient from the United States.
When permission?
No, thank you. If the Soviet Union had survived, it would have only done so in a plan that included significant foreign aid from the United States. Is it really does the Soviet Union serve its purpose on the global stage as a counterbalance to the USA if it can only survive by taking the USA's foreign investment and foreign aid? I don't think so. And finally, I'd just like to say and point out the failings on a lower level. In 1986, you had Chernobyl, an entirely sort of avoidable disaster and one caused by Soviet mismanagement. You had the shooting of KAL-007, a 747 flying for Korean Air, with the loss of 270 innocent lives. Once again, a failing by the Soviet military, which was completely avoidable, but because of the deeply ingrained issues in the Soviet state apparatus, it sadly occurred. The Soviet Union was a failed state, arguably from the beginning. The ideals it was based upon were flawed fundamentally, and its fall was not something to regret, not something to be sad about, but an inevitability. The fact that it happened as soon as it did was a good thing. Thank you.
Thank you, Jonathan, and I'd like to welcome Ethan McGarry.
Comrades of House, members of the Politburo, and especially General Secretary Tulcha, the opposition will have you believe that the Soviet Union was this big, evil, bad man that from the start was set out on failed ideals to rob the people of the Soviet Union and the Russian people and all of its constituent republics of everything they have for vanity projects and nothing more. I would like to counter that with some interesting statistics. So, education under the Soviet Union. Compared to Tsarist and Western standards, 44% of scientists were women. So the gender equality was far better than it was in the West compared to 10% today. That stat was taken in the 1970s. So I can't see much, you know, being wrong with that. The Soviet Union eradicated illiteracy due to their technical colleges, where they embraced the ability of their people and they trained them to be scientific and engineering marvels. No, thank you. Housing as well was enshrined, under the Soviet Constitution. And while the opposition may go on to argue that... the opposition may go on to argue that, you know, the Soviet citizens lived in squalor. You know, they had terrible housing and they really suffered under their housing quality. Everyone was housed, weren't they?
On
that
point.
No. And even today, enshrined in the at the fall of the SSR, the right to shelter was enshrined. And in the 1960s and towards the 70s, 2.2 million units were built every single year for families to live and thrive, compared to the West, which they don't give a rat's ass. 5% of a family's income was dedicated to rent, which in practice was about 3%. In the West, it's 50%. And in modern Russia, it has climbed to 70% now. And that is a massive wealth disparity among the post-Soviet people. Post-breakup, homelessness has skyrocketed, with private landlords swiping up all Soviet-built housing for their own gain. As well, and the opposition has made the point that the fall of the USA has, you know, they could bore us with the political parts of it. But the fall of the USSR, has led to the USA becoming unchecked until very recently with the rise of China. And this has led to the overreach of Western imperialism into post-Soviet countries and into the global south. The USSR supported many, many countries within the global south, such as Angola, which has suffered under the collapse because they lacked the funding that was provided due to the Soviets.
On that point?
No. I'll give you an example from the 1970s, the Vulcan, West Virginia incident, where a bridge had collapsed in one of the most rural and impoverished areas of the USA. And the US government would not let aid go to this town to rebuild the only route into their community. The Soviet Union, seeing this, said, yeah, we'll pay for it. And we're very ready to provide aid to this very impoverished working class area that had been decimated under Western and US imperialism because the US did not care about the working people. And as soon as the USSR agreed to providing this aid, the USA immediately backtracked and was like, yeah, we'll pay for it, because they were like, we don't want to look bad. So the USA will only did things because the USSR made them look bad, which really provides a perfect analogy for how the USA operated. It's, we don't want to look bad on the global stage. So, you know, go ahead.
You say that the USA didn't want to look bad on the global stage. Why then did the USSR dedicate so much money to vanity projects designed to make themselves look good on the global stage instead of, you know, feeding their population?
Well, that's a very interesting statistic. By the 1970s, they actually, in a CIA report of the Soviet Union, they had better nutritional standards, and Soviet people were actually more nutritionally fed than anywhere else in the West.
On that point.
Stop starving.
Thanks, Kira. Thank you. So, where was that? Yeah. Modern Russia, currently, is by far worse than the Soviet Union, and a majority of Russian citizens and citizens in other post-Soviet countries, such as Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, I can't list all the stands, so I'm not going to try, believe that life was better under the Soviet Union. With these oppressed people, no. Believe that the grand tyranny of the Soviet Union was better than their current state. Homelessness skyrocketed. Abuse of women skyrocketed. Human rights dropped as soon as the Soviet Union fell.
On that point.
Okay.
you've listed a whole lot of things which were supposed to be better under the USSR, like housing. You do know they kept killing people, that's why they had housing.
This is in like the 1950s, this is like in the 1960s after de-Stalinization, so realistically they weren't killing people. You're referring to the Stalinist period, which many people were killed, but these statistics are from the 70s and 80s, where Nikita Khrushchev had begun his de-Stalinization and had prevented the killing. So, where was I? And just a final funny point, the USA won the space race, and we all love space. The Soviet, and as well, the opposition is claiming that the decline of the Soviet Union was because of vanity projects. Realistically, the economic decline of the Soviet Union was due to the renewed arms race after détente. And due to this increase in arms spending, the Soviet Union couldn't keep up because the West had already industrialized 100 years earlier. The Soviet Union could not, in reality, keep up with the US and the rest of the West, which is by far, far ahead of it. And the jumps that it made from basically a serfdom state to an industrialized, on par with the West society in 100 years was by far one of the best things to happen. And I don't have any more points, so.
Right, so I made a POI to start off this debate, and it still hasn't been addressed. So for those of you who don't know, this House regrets debates are very specific. They have to provide an alternative history. They have to explain how that alternative history would come about, and they would have to explain what the world would look like after the fall of the USSR and how it would be better than the world we live in today. They have not done this at all. They've talked about the past, nothing but the past. You actually mentioned Russia in World War II, completely ignoring the fact that Stalin actually ignored 80 intelligence warnings that people were going to invade. But we'll ignore that, you know, because at the end of the day, you need to actually talk about, they talk about, oh great, these people rose from the ashes and they were an economic powerhouse. No, they weren't. So essentially what happened was, you have to understand where they started off with. Where they started off with. So essentially they were a very impoverished, very underdeveloped nation. So because of this, they essentially piggybacked off the West. And because of this, their productivity shot up to the sky. But what happens when the West didn't have any advancements? Well, did the Soviets have any economic advancements? Oh no, it didn't, which was why suddenly it shot up to the sky and crashed and burned in the 80s. And the issue was, like, intrinsic problems with socialism and how their economy was structured that they don't want to talk about because it's actually a good point. Because the way their economy was structured is based on communism. So essentially, their way of handling their economy meant that their whole industrialization was inefficient. Also, it meant that you had a lot of power in a lot of different pockets, and people didn't want to change the economic model because it meant that people would lose power.
On that point?
No. So what ended up happening was you had a nation that desperately needed to shift more to Western ideals. But because everyone was so attached to communism and so attached to the model that they had built, and they had power because of this economic model that they built, they couldn't shift. So they did weird half measures that didn't work. And because of this, the economy just kept getting tankier. So the point where they had to keep printing money to fund their factories to house their people because they didn't have any. Later on, they had to basically artificially bump up the ruble, but otherwise their economy was going to tank into the ground. And they have not provided any possibility of how the USSR would survive that. They have not done that. I have listened. They have not provided any reasoning as to how the USSR would survive their economic collapse. You have not provided that. No, thank you. You have also not provided the fact that, realistically, if the USSR were to survive, they would have to adopt an economic model that was more like China. And along with that economic model, to stop the Warsaw Pact countries rebelling and basically going, nah, we're not getting money or food or anything like that, they would have to roll down on them like an iron fist, which in the alternative history would lead to these Warsaw Pact countries basically having to get essentially a more totalitarian regime, because you couldn't afford them to rise up and leave. So you would have to squash freedom of speech, you would have to squash any attempt to organize, you would have to squash anything, otherwise the whole empire would break apart the seams. Literally, there was later on in Soviet history, actually, the same reason after the USSR fell. Literally, one person rose up and said something which made sense, that people around Russia were going, wait a minute, why is all this money being spent in Warsaw Pact countries, and why is all this money being spread so thin? Well, you could just take the money back and use it to sustain a smaller kind of population, smaller countries, which makes more sense. And now, we continue on to this idea. So what would have happened if, let's pretend that the USSR survived, right? So as I said, they had to,
I think you're being that you know as well as I do that just because it's a regrets motion doesn't mean they need to propose an alternative history.
Yes, it
that's
does.
That's pretty disingenuous.
It does.
The point I want to make is that they seem to have focused on the consequences, the negative consequences of the fall of the Soviet Union, which is perfectly within the motion. And for you to refuse to engage in that because they haven't done it in the way that you would have done it, I mean, that's fine, because we need disingenuous.
No, because
yeah.
It's...
Yeah.
Right, so in response to that, they do have to talk about what would the world have looked like after the fall, after if the Soviet Union survived. And they also have to explain how that would have happened. And what I'm saying is, realistically, if it would have survived, you would have had to do a lot of nasty, negative things to make that happen, which they're not acknowledging. I'm trying to compare the two universes. They haven't done that, really. They haven't compared the two universes. That's what I'm saying here. You can't just go Soviet Union good. That's not the point. You have to essentially compare what would have happened if the Soviet Union fell versus what if it didn't fall. And you also have to, as part of that, explain how the Soviet Union would have survived and what impact would have that had on the global stage. That's what the point of a regrets motion is. Now, and this is what I'm saying, because let's face it, the USSR was an economic decline. The Warsaw Pact countries essentially want their own independence, they want their own lives, they wanted to be able to control their own sovereignty. So they were going to break off eventually. If they didn't, then they would have had to rule over them like an iron fist. And with their economic resources spread so thin, that it would be a wounded dog limping along for a bit of longer before someone thankfully came along and shot in the head. The fall of the USSR was inevitable. The only difference is the world would have looked worse had it continued on a bit longer. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sarah, and I'd like to welcome Chairman Tracy off to close the proposition.
Hello, folks. Oh, yes, please. Right, I believe there's a PowerPoint here. If not, that's a shit. Oh, thank fuck. Next item. Yes, it's our a tale of tragedy and a group of Sheffield. Peace. Next item, please.
Right, so there you see Gorbachev here. Both Reagan, the great man Reagan, and George and Bush Sr. sat in front of the Twin Towers.
Why is tragedy in inverted commas?
It is my personal opinion that the fall of the USSR led directly to the tragedy of the whatever your opinions are on the event of 9/11, it was an event that happened, and it was historic, and it was something that happened. Gorbachev's a massive traitor, betrayed his nation and the revolution to Western capitalism.
He was a bit of a cunt.
Anyway, so I'm just going to start off by saying, disregard everything fucking Cormac said here. What in the utter fuck? You can call me a tank, you can call me a red fascist, but based is what I am. The opposition here spoke about murder. What murder?
On that point,
you fuck yourself. The USSR was a nation that completely stood against the majority of the rest of the world. And so, of course, it's not going to be pretty, despite what Kier would want it to be. It's not going to be a vast utopia immediately. There's going to be some murder, there's going to be some death, there's going to be a few
hits. On that point?
No, not at all. The fuck is that? Next up, please. Here's Gorbachev doing a fantastic commercial, for a brand called Pizza Hut. I don't know if any have got off that. It's a mediocre pizza you might get here in Belfast. But yeah, Gorbachev sold our soul and the entire soul of the revolution to Pizza Hut, primarily, and then Western capitalism through that. He also appeared in an epic rap album. It was kind of big for him. Yeah.
You do realise that's an absolute gem of an ad, and we wouldn't have gotten it without the fall of the USSR. The fall of the USSR is a great thing.
I didn't find that relevant at all to the conversation going on, but please talk to me after.
How is this relevant?
Yeah!
Exactly. No barking, Cormac. Right, what else? Couldn't hold the candle with Stalin, the most base man in history. If any of you have seen a photo of young Stalin, he's so hot. He's so hot. He robbed banks for the revolution. He here would have the... I would love for you to be sat down there and actually participate in this debate, but sadly, you withdrew. So if you could, at any point, actually participate in this debate, it would be fantastic.
No.
But, please, it can take the rest of my time. The other side has spoken enough for there. But what else? Spend the rest of his life as a grifter completely, yep, until he died last year. Ah, he died last year. Fantastic. Great stuff. Gorbachev died. Great stuff. What else have I wrote here? The opposition.
On that point?
Sure, bro.
Are you more sad about the death of Gorbachev or the death of the 60 to 120 million people who died within the USSR?
I'm happy at the death of Gorbachev. There was no sadness at all. I popped a bottle of champagne. I had a great time when Gorbachev died. 60 million. Was it 60 million? 60 to 120. Western capitalist statistics, I wouldn't trust them. But anyway, the fall of the USSR was not the fall of communism. Cormac, alright. Cuba still exists, China still exists.
I defended them in my speech.
You did shit in your speech. For this side, you were a... The USSR was a kind of cool place that should not have went away. And it is quite sad it went away at a wee tier 20 years ago. Ah, please, focus on that. His son did 9/11 if he doesn't. And I think that should be more focus of this debate. Did George Bush do 9/11? Should be an odd bit here. Please segue that later. But, I...
Why is
Top
Ryan,
stop! Sorry. Blame Ryan Hawaii, the HLM, for my state. I fought Gorbachev, guys. Shit place.
have much else to say. All I've been talking against is a man who spoke to me on our side, a BBC reporter. Here, you're quite nice. I'm not going to slander you. I quite like you, to be fair.
Thank you.
Thank you, folks. I really actually had bits of a speech written for this, but I'm so shocked by everything the proposition has said that all of it is irrelevant. My original point was going to be that come the end of the USSR, putting it out of its misery is the best thing. It was a bird with a broken wing. It was never going to prosper again. Its military, its scientific community, its technological advancements, they were all done. It was an economic shithole. Its politics was a shithole. The USSR was the geopolitical party guest which completely refused to leave, but at some point you just have to bite the bullet and go, thank you, it was nice having you, but it's time to go. Starting off, Cormac, you claim to have studied communism and socialism in great detail.
I said Irish socialist.
Right, that's still, you got almost everything about communism and the Soviet Union wrong. You said that I was going to stand up and call you a little Stalinist, which is exactly what I'm doing. You are a little Stalinist, clearly. You said that the
Can we not rotate in the corner?
Sorry,
fucking corner
here.
Next ordinary meeting. Next ordinary meeting. I will bring an official motion.
They kill him.
Well, I don't care. But yeah, you said that it was a sacrifice for which the world owes a great good. It was a sacrifice which killed millions of people. They killed just as many people as Nazi Germany.
It's not true, though.
On that point,
yeah.
Do you not think it's an unfair comparison when Nazi Germany was...
No, I really don't. Okay. You started talking about ideal socialism. That's... Well, not what this debate is about. This debate is about the USSR. Unless you're going to stand up and say that at one point the Soviet Union was ideal communism and that's what it should have like stuck with and that's what it would have come back to had it not fallen, then your point is entirely irrelevant. You've said that since the fall of the USSR, Europe has become more conservative, more conservative and more right-wing. So are you really trying to say that Europe has become less progressive when the Eastern Bloc was reintegrated? I'll take your point. Ethan, you stood up and gave what was a bit of a skit and said that I was going to stand up and say that the Soviet Union was a big evil bad man with failed ideals. That's exactly what I'm doing. You laughed at yourself and said that this was about the fall of the USA, which you talked about nutrition. You talked about nutrition. The reason their nutrition was better is because they didn't have the freedom to choose. They were eating their lettuce leaves, which very rarely grew. They weren't able to walk into McDonald's and order a Big Mac. Do you have a point?
I love being a comedian. That was my point.
Okay, can I take another point?
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
So, if you think that it's completely in our... If you think it's part of freedom and that we should be able to walk in the Big Mac, or walk in the Big Mac wherever we want, do you not feel that it is better for a nation to just say that people as though they provide meaningless schlop?
Yes, but they didn't feed them, ran out of food, and people died. That's the simple answer. Western nations, you know, in Europe, do actually feed their people, and they are not communist.
On that point.
Yeah.
They couldn't feed their people because the kulaks were doing scorched earth tactics on their own fields and slaying all the animals and.
Well, the interesting thing about the kulaks is that the stupid economic plan was that they were just going to eliminate all the actual efficient farmers who knew what they were doing. And that was a really, really bad idea because that's how you end up with famine, that's how you end up with Lottomer, which ended up being classified as a genocide, including by historians in this university. Cormac said Stalin good, Ethan said Stalin bad, and Tiernan tried to kill himself. are you on the second beer yet?
Yes, I am.
You completely disregarded everything that was said by your own side. You talked about how the USSR was on some great plan to become a utopia, but it reached a peak, it reached a heyday, and it never reached utopia status. I don't understand why you think that this big curve where it reaches its peak around, you know, 60s, and then an immediate decline was going to, like, end up being the perfect society. Your Gorbachev hit piece was funny, applauding death was interesting, and I really want to talk more about your 9/11 fetish. But simply, the USSR was just a failed state. It was unviable, it was undemocratic, and it was unworthy of remaining a country. A state which killed so many millions of its own citizens. It was a state in which I certainly wouldn't want to live. I'm willing to bet the opposition wouldn't want, or the proposition wouldn't want to live there either. And it's a state in which the proposition are trying to tell you was God's greatest gift. All members of this house from Ireland, North, South, East and West need to vote with the opposition tonight. Everyone needs to vote with the opposition tonight, because otherwise you are not condemning everything that came out of their mouths.
On that point?
Yes.
So you're saying everybody needs to vote against the proposition. That sounded like a collectivist thought.
As much as the proposition have been trying to make this out, this was not a communism versus capitalism debate. This was a debate about the USSR. This was a debate where they should have stood up and said the USSR was a counterbalance to the US and they propelled each other to new heights. But no, they stood up and then worshipped Stalin, called out Stalin, said Stalin was good, and then said Stalin was bad. If I was Ronald Reagan, I would stand up and do a skit. I'm not Ronald Reagan, and I'm not confident enough to do what I was originally planning. But it's just insane. The Soviet Union was like a banged up ladder. It was running out of gas. It was an absolute piece of shit on the geopolitical highway, and it finally pulled over and burst into flames. And we should be saying, thank God that nuisance of a thing is gone and it's off the roads. But what they stood up and said is, oh, I wish we could still drive it. It should still be roadworthy and it should pass the MOT. That's nonsense, and thank you. Vote with the opposition.
Can we have a second round of applause for a maiden speaker as well, please? And you skipped your ballet. There was a whole slide with ballerinas on it.
Like, I was going to play Swan Lake and do a little dance and then do the Reagan impression.
We'll move on to questions instead. No, Rory, no point of order. The way the questions work is I'll ask a question for the proposition. One person can respond, and then someone from the opposition is to respond to them. So do we have a question for the proposition? I'll go to James. Oh, who wants to respond?
I will take that. Yes, the one person can respond.
I would like to use this time now to ask a serious question to the opposition. I just don't take that seriously, look at the other side.
It was honestly really, really bad. I feel sorry for myself that I cracked real points and then sort of listened to what like you had to
say. You've got three comedians here.
Do we have a question for the opposition? They did actually
kind of.
Daniel.
It's sort of branching off what I said here earlier, which fair enough, you gave a response, and that's fine. But given that, you know, they're trying to
salvage any kind of point out
they did say stop. You said that it was the right stuff. That's fine, it wasn't the right stuff. But they did say stuff. Do any of you feel like now this is not this is not present to them? But it is a bit of an impact on you, and I think you guys should, instead of doing what you've done, I think you should actually address, pick one, and then address them.
I'd say a lot of the stuff I talked about in my speech quite comprehensively. I mean, there weren't many points to sort of counter, but I think a lot of what I talked about in mine did sort of lay quite a few of their points to rest. They kept sort of pretending like I'd said, for instance, they kept sort of making the straw man and saying that we were arguing that the economy had gone down the hill just because of vanity projects, when we clearly said that it was because of the Soviets copying of Western technology, catching up with them once there was no more innovation to copy. And like, yeah, I'd say you sort of covered quite a lot of what they then said later adequately.
Proposition to respond, who would like to?
I thought that I did go into detail about how since the 1990s, prosperity, getting rid of pensions, through transing away the NHS, everything else, how things have got worse, and that was the alternative reality that I was presenting. Now, I know you didn't really address that, and listen to it here, but that's there.
Do we have an abstaining question, Sam?
This isn't strictly an abstaining
that's
question.
That's not
his. But could Ryan do his little dance anyway?
Jonathan and I have prepared alternative lyrics to Video Killed the Radio Star called Gorbachev Killed the USSR.
Can I get time for that?
And proposition to respond to Gorbachev killed the USSR. And
I see we're gonna respond.
We already have one. I'm gonna do another round of questions. Did I salvage something? Do we have a question for the proposition? I'll go to Adam Mandel.
I mean, I don't know all of you personally, but I know some of you too personally. most of you, if not all of you, on the proposition would argue that you're leftists, fair enough. However, some of you, if not all of you, would argue that you're nationalists. As leftists, as nationalists, how do you kind of, come to terms with the USSR as both quite an uncompassionate institution and an institution which quashed any sort of nationalism?
Who would like to
answer?
Whenever you have nationalists, whenever you anarchists have a success for revolution, then you can come back.
would the opposition like to respond, Kira?
The issue with the USSR was essentially what ended up happening was to control its own populace to stop it from leaving. They had to essentially quash any freedom of speech, quash anything like that. Then Gorbachev came along and went, oh yeah, glasnost. And then what ended up happening was the more kind of nationalist, more totalitarian kind of side of the party basically tried to kill Gorbachev because, and at any economic reform that was needed to actually like progress the USSR, literally its own system held it back. Like literally, Khrushchev tried to introduce very minor economic reform and he then had to redo it because he faced so much backlash from it. He did the exact same thing. Like literally glasnost had to happen because if it didn't happen, then essentially everyone around him would have gone, no, if you changed it, then we wouldn't have any power anymore. So keep it as the same broken, awful system. So at the end of the day, the USSR was never going to change. It was never gonna become this great nation because it had such systematic flaws in both its economy, in both its way of governance that was always going to hold it back and leave it to the inevitable failure. It was just a question of when. And at the end of the day, if it struggled on for like a couple more decades, it would just lead to, again, mass kind of not freedom of speech. It would have led to probably start more issues of starvation because, again, there was this problem where they kept all the wealth in Moscow and then the outer countries kind of suffered, but as the resources were stretched more and more thinly. So at the end of the day, we live in a more free society that USSR is gone, because at least those nations that were part of the Warsaw Pact can actually have their say and they can talk about it. And even like, if there were two massive superpowers, that wouldn't have led to any more peace. It would have just led to multiple proxy wars because they were like closer to each other, especially like Yugoslavia. That would have just turned into a massive proxy war that would have turned into basically Vietnam or South Korea. And that would have just kept happening again and again and again. So more mass murder, more mass everything. So that's the reality that would have happened, not what they're saying about one country out of the entire world with austerity, by the way. Let's continue on.
And do we have a question for the opposition? Will to you. So could you just get your name?
Hi, I'm Sid. So the question was about international stability. So would you say that, obviously, given the current situation in Ukraine, which could plausibly be argued to have been created by Western imperial overreach, the arguments there, would you say that actually having those two big powers made the world more stable, and arguably that Russia may be more dangerous in its current manifestation as a result of not being a superpower, and therefore the Soviet Union would actually have been a beneficial part of this international system?
Who would like to take this on the off?
You're talking about Russia and Ukraine, and that's a very specific example. The Soviet Union being such a large bloc of constituent nations meant that it could quash internal rebellion quite easily. You weren't going to have they weren't civil wars so much as just oppression of citizens in certain areas. Obviously, having more countries is going to create more international unrest rather than just national unrest. I don't think you can equate Russia's current instability with the fall of the USSR. Because you also have to look at how it gifted us other new republics, Estonia, Lithuania, Latvia, all who adhere to like a rough model of Western democracy and have embraced the great goodness that is capitalism. They've reintegrated with the rest of the world. They contribute to NATO, the European Union. They're generally what we would recognize, or at least I would recognize, I believe a majority of the House would recognize as a force for good. I think that sums it up.
Proposition to respond?
I would think that the war over Ukraine is a proxy war between the US and NATO, and by NATO, America. And I would say that if you look at the past grievances between the USSR and America, such as the Cuban Missile Crisis, I would say that if you look at the past experiences between where Russia has came from being in the USSR to then modern Russia, and then its involvement with the Ukraine, where the conflict between the USSR and Russia was, especially the Cuban Missile Crisis, as I was saying, it was a better and it ended up more nicely than the conflict currently in Ukraine.
You actually got someone serious out of this. And do we have an abstaining question? Keir, please.
I think one thing that I've really noticed has been like fallout events, like after the fall, that we sort of like talk about how they're having to go about. Like, say for example, one thing that comes to mind is Yugoslavia became a lot more paranoid after the fall of the USSR because they felt a lot less safe in that they didn't have an ally. They were neutral, but like they sort of felt the sum. But like I just sort of wonder, like when it comes to fallout events like that after the fall of the USSR, what does both sides have to say on those matters, on how it might, on how it like contributes to their position?
For opposition to respond first.
I would say that at no point the Yugoslavia ever felt really safe with the USSR. Tito was constantly under assassination threats from the USSR. Once we're back, just say, set him on. Really fucking funny. But if you're talking about fallout events, there were a lot of repercussions. Jesus Christ. There were a lot of repercussions after the USSR fell. And by fuck, I hope the people that jump back out.
Opposition, there was.
So. 9/11 happened as a repercussion of the end.
So, once again, the proposition continues to be one of the best, some of the best debaters for the opposition. What they just said about Tito was pretty much what we would have said in terms of the fall of the USSR didn't really change the thing there, because the USSR was a threat to Yugoslavia. But generally, when an empire falls, there's an element of fallout. You look at the fall of the British Empire, there was fallout there. You look at the fall of the French Empire, look at the fall of the American Empire with Vietnam. The issue is, ultimately, these sorts of things were inevitably going to happen when the USSR fell. And as we've laid out, the USSR falling wasn't an if, it was a when. It was inevitable that it would fall, and when it did fall, these sorts of events are just a natural consequence whenever that happens.
William, and we'll move on to our vote on speaker ability. This isn't about your own personal opinion, it's about which side you think spoke best tonight. So if you think that this side, the proposition, spoke best, please raise your hand on.
Proposition?
Four. Six, seven. Seven. Yes. And if you think that the opposition spoke best tonight, please raise your hand on.
Gulag, that's on our side.
You're welcome. This is more technical too, yeah. It's because we're done on comments.
And if you would like to abstain on tonight's vote, please raise your hand now. Six. Mr. Secretary, could you please read out the vote on speaker ability?
Okay, so the motion this House regrets the fall of the USSR. The vote on speaker ability was as follows: 7 votes for the top, 20 for the op, and 6 abstentions. So the opposition has it.
Well done to the opposition. Next week's debate is This House Believes Achieving Net Zero is Not Worth the Cost, so please come. We're all going to libraries after this, and could all speakers please come forward for a picture as well. Stand on all the tables.